Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
So this is a speaker meeting. I will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Paul, who will share his experience, strength, and hope. Standing up. All right. My name is Rami. I'm an alcoholic.
Rami.
It's good to be here, and I want to thank Morgan for allowing me to be of service tonight. And this is not about me. This is about what I can give back to AA, which has given me so much. And just reminding myself of that makes me a little less freaked out standing in front of all of you. So welcome to the newcomers. AA is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. I am completely 100% in love with this program, and I love it more every day. So just really quickly, what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Well, my sobriety date is October 28th, 2003. So in October, I'll have 7 years of continuous sobriety. I got here a month to the day after my 22nd birthday. So I came here really young, but I was in the depths of hell. I had no further down to go, so I came here when I came here. You know, one thing I related to when I first got here was when people said that they just didn't, they didn't really fit in or they didn't feel good. I just remember feeling that way when I was younger. Like, everybody had gotten somehow like the cool chip except for me, and I just felt like a total dumbass all of the time. And I just would be with like groups of people or whatever, and I would just feel so self-conscious and ugly and stupid, and I didn't know what to say, and I didn't know how to act, and everything that I said was dumb, and it just sucked. Like, it sucked to be me. And I had this huge hole in my soul. And I didn't know then what I know now, that the only thing that fills that hole is God and service. I know that now, and I'm so grateful for that. So I grew up in Palo Alto, like a fairly normal childhood. I started partying by the end of high school, and I started to feel a little bit better, you know. I started to kind of feel like I could kick it, you know, like maybe I could hang out, you know. And I came to the East Bay. I came to Berkeley to go to school, and, you know, I was going to school. You know, I've always really kind of prided myself on being a student. I've always done well in school. I've always liked school, and that's a really big part of who I am. I was going to school, and I was in my apartment. I lived right on Telegraph Avenue, and I saw a commercial on TV, and, you know, I share this all the time, and it was an anti-meth campaign commercial, and it was, like, this really skinny girl, like, this got silent, wearing, like, next to nothing, looking real hot, you know, cleaning her bathroom with a toothbrush or something, and I was like, holy shit, she's hot, skinny, with a clean-ass bathroom, like, I've got to get me some of that. So, you know, thanks to the anti-meth campaign, you know. So I did, and, you know, like, whatever, man, like, my lungs filled with air for the first time. It was like I'd been searching for that for you know, 19 years. I looked in the mirror, man, I was so beautiful. I was talking, oh, my God, it was amazing. You know, my solution was found. It was done. It was over. Like, there is a God, thank you. I found what I've been looking for. I'm complete. Yeah, so it turned on me super fast. I don't need to go into what hell it becomes because we got here, because it turned into a living hell. The most painful part of my drug abuse and alcoholism was what it did to the people that loved me, because I was fucked up, you know, whatever. I was fucked up. But it tore my parents' heart out. They had no idea what was going on. You know, they're living in their little suburban home in Palo Alto, and all of a sudden, their daughter is gone. Like, I was there, I was still kind of going to school, living in the apartment, but I was gone. There was no one home. And my dad was like, oh, it wrenched his heart out of his chest. He was calling me obsessively on the phone, and he'd have nothing to say. He would just call me just to hear my voice and try to connect with me, and there was no one there to connect with. And, you know, things got horrible. You know, of course, I ended up dropping out of school. that was really incomprehensibly demoralizing, dropping out, because I dropped out more than once. And I love school. You know, I love school, and I knew I couldn't manage it, and there was no possible way I could manage it. Things were ugly. They were so ugly. And at first I was like, oh, these people are my friends. Like, this is great, you know, and it was horrible. It was hell. It was literally a living hell. And you know, a few years later, like, my parents finally caught on what was going on, and they came to me and said, well, actually, I came home for a weekend once, and I just looked like hell. And my mom took me aside, and she's like, are you on heroin? And I'm like, no, I'm on meth. Do you want to smoke some with me? And because she and I smoked weed together growing up, and I was like, maybe she'll want to. And her jaw dropped to the floor. And probably the week later, like, my parents were like, no more school, no more apartment, like, the funds are ending, like, you either come home with us or we're done and we love you, but we can't fund your death anymore. Because not only were they funding my addiction, they were funding my boyfriend's addiction and his mom's, who were all living in the apartment that my father was paying for, so I could go to school. So I said, okay, see ya, bye, peace. So, you know, that allowed me to hit bottom really fast. So, you know, thank God my parents decided not to fund my demise any longer, because I got to see what it was really like out there. And it's hell. No one loved me. No one loved me. And it was bleak. My addiction leads me into insanity. So, you know, psych wards, all that. I went to a few different rehabs. Didn't stick. Eventually, things in Berkeley got so dangerous and so bad that I went to one last rehab. I was 22 years old. I was completely insane. I had nowhere left to go. Nowhere. I didn't have a single belonging. I had nowhere left to go. And, you know, I was a little shit running around the rehab, you know, with an attitude, whatever. And I had this counselor who I absolutely hated. But she said, I just remember someone just, you know, suggesting I pray to God and ask to do God's will. And I didn't know what the hell she was talking about, and I don't know why I did it, but I was blessed with step one. I was completely powerless over drugs and alcohol, and my life had become completely unmanageable. There was not a single possible shred of manageability left in my life, and I didn't really know that here. I knew it in my blood. I knew it in my gut. Like, it was up. Like, I could either go into the door of hell and death and misery or God in AA, and I was led by my higher power to the God in AA door. And I'm really grateful for that. I didn't deserve it, and I'm blessed. So I started praying to God. I didn't mean it. I don't know what I was doing. It didn't matter. It doesn't matter. I said it. That's what I tell people too. I don't care whether you mean it or not. Just say it anyway. Just try it. It can't hurt. So I started praying to God, and it didn't take long. It took a few days, and God came to me. I went this far, and God went the rest. So I had a spiritual experience, and I lost the obsession to use. I had cravings, and when the cravings would come, I would just say a million times over, like a mantra, God, please remove the obsession. And I don't know if I believed it or not. I said it because I knew I was going to die if I kept using. And the obsession was relieved. And I don't want to use anymore. I don't want to drink anymore. God removed that obsession for me. And that's the only thing that removed it was God. It was nothing I did. And I don't even know what that means. It doesn't matter. I just know God did it. So basically, recovery for me has meant turning my will and my life over to the care of my higher power every day. And that has opened up an entire world to me, a world where I get to own my stuff and I get to look people in the eye I've harmed and make amends and walk away feeling like I'm walking on air. And it's better than getting high. That feeling I have when I'm good with God, it's unbelievable. I remember when I made a really important amends to my old manager of my apartment complex, whose life, I put him and his wife and baby's life in danger by the people I was having running around my apartment. And his cousin worked at a Bay Isle smoke shop on Telegraph. This was a year and a half after I'd gotten sober. And my manager had moved away to LA, but I knew his cousin ran that shop. So I wrote him a letter of amends, and I had him give it to his brother in LA, whose, you know, wife and daughter and his life I had put in danger by the people I had in my place. And I gave that letter over to Al or whoever. And I walked down Telegraph, and I felt God so fucking strongly. Like, it was amazing. And making amends to me has been such a huge part of my recovery. There's nothing like it. So actually, all those years, what I've been searching for was God. I just didn't know it. I heard someone say in a meeting once that they felt like their alcoholism was just a trick to get them to God, and that's how I feel too. There's nothing that my higher power doesn't take today. There's not one thing that my higher power won't take if I give it to my higher power. The things that still fuck me up are things that I don't want to hand over. So, like, when Morgan asked me to chair the meeting, to do the 10 opener today, it's like, no, I don't want to. That's my initial reaction for everything. I see a woman walking towards me to ask me to be her sponsor. I want to run the other direction. Like, that is my initial first response for anything. And it's only God and AA that allows me to pause and do the right thing and say, yes, I want to be of service. I want to give back what was given to me. And that fills me up today. And that gives me joy today. If there's anything else I want to say. I don't know, you know, like, doesn't matter about the frills or whatever I have or whatever I'm doing. It's all about me and God today. It's all about being of service today. I could totally do more, but I accept where I'm at, and this is just the biggest gift I've ever been given. It's restored my life. It's restored my family. I'm so, so grateful today to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The principles of this program are, I can't find a single loophole. Like, I looked for the loophole and there isn't one. It's about tolerance, it's about kindness, it's about love, it's about being of service and asking nothing in return. And the more I do that, the more I love myself. And I have this, like, center or core that, like, nothing can shake. Like, nothing, no matter what happens, no matter who dies, no matter who acts funky, like, doesn't matter, because, like, there's this connection to me and my God that nothing can touch. And that's pretty cool, you know? And it just keeps getting better, you know, it keeps getting better and better. And I'm so grateful to be here, and thanks for letting me be of service. Okay, so now I'd like to turn the meeting over to tonight's speaker, Paul.
I'm Paul. I'm an alcoholic. Without a doubt. And I did the research. It's conclusive. And I want to just thank Morgan for asking me to speak here tonight, you know. And I'm a little intimidated. I'm not going to say nervous. Intimidated, because you guys, this crowd is like, you know, you guys got good bullshit detectors, I can tell. You know what I'm saying? And, but you know, I'm just gonna say what's on my heart, because that's what I've listened to in this program, and that's who I've gravitated to in the message when I first started, and that's what's worked for me, you know. And, I wanna first say it's really nice to know Raimi, because I remember when she came in, and I have a home group. One home group is Drunks R Us in Berkeley, top of Solano and the Alameda. So check it out. Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. And but anyway, I'll just what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I'll say, you know, first off, I'm 55 years old already. Oh my God, how did that happen? You know, but I've been clean and sober for 25 years as of July 11th, you know, and I'm like, man, how'd that get here already? And, but, you know, it's really, you know, to be asked to share here, it's really an honor, you know, and it really is an honor. And, you know, just like Raimi said, you know, to give back what was so freely given, you know. And when I first sobered up, it's not because one day I'm skipping along going, oh, gee, I think I want to change my life, you know. And no, it didn't happen like that. You know, it was, I grew up in Berkeley, you know. I was a kid in the 60s during their fun time, you know. Telegraph Avenue buying different colored rolling papers and like, wow, groovy, man. And it really was. And, you know, it was. It was a real lot of fun. That's when all the Rolling Stones music was coming out and all that. It was, wow, it was really a fun time to be a kid, you know. And my parents, I was born in Santa Barbara. My parents got divorced when I was really young. My mom, age 20, had three kids right in a row, bam. And then it didn't work out, and she came up here with my stepfather, who was turned out to be a high school English teacher in Union City. And we came to Berkeley. They rented a little bungalow right on University Avenue. And right next to the train station, there used to be a Foster and Kleiser billboard in a little bungalow. And then there was like JV Liquors, and they tore that down. I don't even know what's there now. But, so I grew up in Berkeley, and my parents were, they were real, civil right, liberal, Jack Kerouac, all that shit, And we're just kids going, whatever, dude, But it was really fun to be around those people. They were like, they really cared about things. They were artists. They were interesting people. But they smoked a lot of cigarettes and drank a lot of martinis, and they were freaking, they had sarcasm, and they were tough to be around as a kid. And I just remember at many junctures, my stepfather had friends who were, went to Cal, and they would all get into these really intense arguments about political things that were topic at the time. And, it was very interesting. And I remember standing back going, I'm sure not going to be like them, or what. And I don't know what happened, but I grew up in the Berkeley schools and started smoking pot in the seventh, eighth grade. It was Garfield in the seventh grade, and then King Junior High in the eighth grade, because 68 when Martin Luther King got assassinated. And I started smoking pot and taking organic drugs, hashish and mescaline and whatever LSD they were cranking out at that time. That was fun, my parents, we lived on the Berkeley-Albany border, and so they decided it would be better if I went to Albany High School in the end of eighth grade, and I was like, oh my God, you're kidding me, You got to throw me to the wolves. What's the difference, So I went to Albany, and we used to have, there was this thing, we thought, it's like Albany was like 10 years behind. Berkeley was like the hippies and the cool thing, and they were like, man, it was still 1957 or something. And so when I went there, when I went to Albany High, I was like terrified. It was like, these guys were tough. They were mean. And they were like, they took reds and drank, alcohol and beat each other up. And so I was like, man, this is rough. So I just aligned myself with a tough couple guys, and it was okay. And so I went to, I managed to get through school, and I really loved art a lot when I was a kid. I loved to just, that pot they got now, it's like indica. It's like you take one hit of that stuff, and I'm going to hide under the freaking couch when it first came out. But when we were kids, it was cannabis sativa, and it was like, you'd smoke a whole, you could get through a whole joint, and you were like, your eyes would get like this, and you just want to go raid the refrigerator and paint a picture or something, Seriously, so I love that shit. So, Peter Max came out, I loved Peter Max and Marvel Comics, so I kind of merged the two together, and smoked pot and just went to school, and I painted a couple huge murals that hung there for about 9 years. And somehow I managed to get through high school, it got a little tough as us young boys came of age. I was the eldest, I have a brother a year younger, and then a brother 2 years younger, and we were all doing that at the same time, and it was just overwhelming for the parents. And I got sat down at like age 17, 16 and said, this is all well and good, whatever the fuck you're doing, but when you're 18, you are out of here, my stepfather. And that just something, it just turned it for me. It's like something very deep inside of me started to have this, fearful, I need more to feel better kind of thing started happening. And, so sure enough, I was 18. It was like, here's the suitcase. See ya. So I went up to Lake Tahoe because my best friend had his parents had a cabin up there, and we worked in the casinos swing shift, bus boys. Man, was that fun. But I couldn't believe how much dope they smoked and alcohol they drank from, we'd work from 4 to 12. Then they'd party till like 3 or 4 in the morning. Get up and then like do it again. And I was like a couple years younger than my best friend, and I just burned out and hit bottom quick. I kind of started getting, it was very evident at that point that this might be a problem for me, the alcohol and drug thing. So at the end of that summer, I don't know, I kind of started having first episodes of toxic psychosis. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that term. Maybe you are. I mean, I don't know. It's just like, it's, anyway, not fun. But so I found myself at Lake Tahoe the end of the summer going, oh my God, what am I going to do now? And somehow I went down, I hitchhiked to Santa Barbara, and my dad talked me into joining the Navy. I was, you know, I got a good idea, son. Why don't you join the Navy? I'm like, fuck, are you kidding me? And he, no, I'm not, you know, and so he did. And I ended up, Jesus Christ, I found myself in boot camp in San Diego looking at the razor wire going, oh my God, what the hell? And I was actually coming off of, like, I took a lot of LSD in high school or something because I was having like this crazy episodes of, I remember being in there and going, man, how did this happen? And it was like at nighttime and I saw something, somebody spray painted on the wall. The best thing about living is dying. That's why you save it for last. You know, Don Juan or something. I'm like, ugh. And but I figured, you know, something started happening where I thought, well, you know what? Maybe I'll stay in here because I don't have a better idea what the hell I'm going to do. I got like set back 2-3 times. And so every time you get set back, the next company you got put into in the boot camp decided to make you an example. Well, don't fuck up, boys, or you're going to get ridden like this guy, you know? And it's like, ah, Jesus. So I got through boot camp, and then I signed on for, it was a 3-year enlistment, then I got another, I signed on for a year to go to A school, aviation. I figured maybe that's how I'll get out of chipping paint on some ship somewhere, you know? And so I ended up going to Memphis, Tennessee, to where they trained you for basic introduction to aviation. I was enlisted, and I did pretty good on test scores, but I fucked up and told him I took a lot of LSD and shit like that. So, bam, no security clearance for him. So it was like, God damn it, I wish I could have done that again. But anyway, I ended up being an aviation structural mechanic with a focus on hydraulics. I'm like, what the hell is that? But I did really well in their schools. I got like third out of 29 or something like this. So they gave me choice orders, and I got to go to, I was supposed to go to Rota, Spain, and be in some spy outfit, fixing these 4-engine turboprops. And, you know, Spain, sign me up, let's go. But no, the night before I was supposed to go get shipped out, I went to this EM club with these other guys. I don't even know what happened, but I woke up the next day. That place was in shambles, and they're like, I had a lot to do with it. Jesus, you know what I mean? God damn it. So, I didn't go to Rota, Spain. I went to Brunswick, Maine, where the snow was this deep. And I'm like, God damn it. And I was still kind of coming off of whatever I had gotten myself. I don't know. This was only a period of like a year. And, you know, so it takes a while to have things cycle out. I don't even know. So I ended up going there, and I was starting to have some problems with there on that base. It was crazy. There was these guys that wanted to go stick up stores late at night, and they wanted me to drive the car. And I'm like, no, I don't want it, you know. And so somehow I got caught between them and the authorities. And I just sort of had a nervous breakdown or something. I don't know what happened. They sent me to some psych hospital. I remember, and of course, I'm drinking excessively and taking lots of drugs at the same time. I never did drugs, you know, with spikes, because when I was a little kid, the doctor had to chase me around the office to give me a shot. So that was kind of good. I just remember having a nervous breakdown, and they sent me to a drug rehab in Florida, Jacksonville, Florida. And I was so relieved just to get the hell out of there. it was like nice and sunny and it was lovely. But most people, they ship you there to, you know, you're out, this is, we'll just send them there and just get them the hell out of the Navy. And they were like, they were really surprised what, like 10% want to stay. And I was like, no, I want to stay in. You know, what the hell am I going to do? They're like, you know, oh no, he wants to stay in. So I can't believe what happened there. I remember, the only thing I remember about that place was some guy, he was really fun and what, one night we were drinking and he drank MD 2020. He's like, let's try slow gin fizzes. I'm like, whatever, dude, you know. And so he drinks this, and I don't know what happened. I had some blackout, but all I remember is they found him naked laying in some ditch. And this is like grass, you know. It's a nice place to pass out, you know. So, and it's hot, it's sunny and lushly green. And I was like, man, I don't know. But somehow, so I ended up coming out to San Francisco. And right here at Moffett Field, VP-47 I ended up being with. It's the big four-engine turboprop planes. Used to be PSA Airlines, and they just fill them full of electronic gear and fly over the ocean and look for submarines and plot ships and what. But I was just a mechanic, you know, in a shop, a new guy. He doesn't know shit. Just have him sweep the place up and don't get in trouble. But it was really fun being there, and I had managed to straighten myself out. I don't know what happened. I mean, I was like, I don't know. I got out here, and it was really good, and it was really fun because it was out in the 4-year enlistment. It was about the 2-year marker, and they take all once a year they deploy to the, you know, Japan. So they all 9 aircraft would fly over there, and us ground pounders would get on some airplane and go to Hawaii and stop over. And I remember doing that. And of course, first thing we wanted to do was smoke whatever pot they had. I got in a lot of trouble just getting there. God, I don't even know how I got through this. Anyway, so we ended up getting to Japan. We get to Japan, and, you know, it was really great. You know, I don't know, it must be that youthful vigor or whatever it was to do all that shit and still be not getting in trouble. I don't know how it happened, but the thing that we got so much trouble over there. I'm from Berkeley, right? So this is 75. So I'm from Berkeley. All these guys are from, you know, Illinois, frickin' Georgia, I don't know. And so the Berkeley guy knows what marijuana looks like, right? So I'm out in the country riding on a bicycle one day, and I'm with this friend of mine, and I swear to God, we're at this fork of this road, and there's like a 5-foot-tall weed plant growing there. And I'm with my friend and go, hey, is that what I think it is? And he's like, what? And I go, that's a pot plant, dude. So we're like, so long story short, we figure out they're so we start cutting down these pot plants and hanging them up underneath the in this foreign land in northern Japan. We just hang them up under these things, and it's not really particularly potent marijuana, but it was, you know, the real thing. So we had this racket going, selling it to these Air Force guys who didn't know shit. And I was just like, you guys just take it over, just you know, whatever, just cut me in or what. And I almost got put in prison over there, 7 years, you know, leave them, me and 3 other guys, because we started this shit or something, so they all figured, oh my God, it was horrible. But anyway, ended up coming home, separating from the Navy, and this was at the end of 1977. Remember, because Elvis Presley had just died. I was like, whoa. You know, and so I decided, I got out of the Navy, and I would go I would go to Santa Barbara, where I'm from, because I used to go visit here when I was as a kid, and it was a wonderful place to be, right? So I get out of there, and I'm going to utilize the GI Bill and go to just junior college and just try to figure out what the hell to do. Just try to stay out of trouble, go to junior college. Okay, good plan, let's go. You know, so I get down there, and I you know, I'm a car mechanic. I'm a mechanic. I've always liked old Jaguar cars, you know. So it's really, you know, I think I bought my first one when I was in high school without my parents' permission, you know. And that started like that. They're like, you know, where the hell did you get this? And anyway, but I've always so. Anyway, so I'm down there, and I'm out, and I just want to. So I buy some old Jag, and I just want to keep it running. So I figured I better just get a job working for somebody, so I can keep my car running. well, I go to junior college, you know. So I started working for these guys down in Santa Barbara, who I learned their main thrust of economic fortune was not fixing cars, it was selling cocaine. And, you know, it was really, I just remember, like, before I got hip to it, it was like on a Friday, all the customers, people would come and pick up their cars, and, oh, there was a whole, you know, like, who's this guy? We didn't fix his car. Who's that? You know, then, you know, we get all hip to it, and this was, you know, these guys, they were pretty big shots. They were like, it came in to them from outside the region, and they just sort of doled it out, ounce form or something, to these people, and, you know, just fix the car, don't get involved, you know, the less you know, whatever. But I mentioned this because what happened to me was I turned probably a 30-year drinking career into about a 4-year thing because I started, you know, chipping with them, just buying a little snow seal bindle with like a quarter grand, $25 back then, and it was like 50 for a half, and what, and man, after... We used to get paid on Friday, and you know, and it progressed to getting paid on Friday to owing all the money on Friday. You know, partying Friday night, waking up Saturday morning going, what the fuck happened? It's a long way till next Friday. I just remember sitting with my, there's avocado orchards down there, and I swear to God, I remember sitting there with my brother one time. And we're like having an avocado, pick an avocado and a loaf of bread and we're having an avocado sandwich. Going, God damn it. It's a long way to next Friday. And, you know, I'm like 26 or 25. I don't know. But, what happened to me was I got such an appetite for alcohol and coke together, you know, that it was just like, and man, was that fun when it was working. I tell you, I love that shit. But, you know, I got what happened to me was I started getting the toxic psychosis started to creep in. And then also, I got like 3 drunk drivings in, or 3 or 4, I can't remember, so long ago, in like a 3-month period. And I thought, God, a little bad luck stretch here. And I remember, I swear to God, when I got the first one, I was crying as he was putting me in the car, and I was going, oh, you made a terrible mistake. And this is terrible, you know. And then freaking a week later, I'm like, just don't do that again. Just not changing my habits whatsoever. You know, really? You know, that was my first introduction to recovery by the state of California. Thought it was a good idea for perhaps I should check this out. So there was OHS, the Occupational Health Services. You know, it was much less expensive to get a drunk driving back then than it is now. I don't even know what it freaking costs right now, but it was bad enough then. I just remember them saying that you're going to go to 3 meetings a week for I forget how long. And I just remember thinking to myself, 3 meetings a week? Oh, my God. How the fuck am I going to squeeze that into my schedule? This is an outrage, this kind of thing, you know? I remember going to that thinking, you know, I really didn't understand Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever this was, I thought it was. They want me to go to this place to see these people and how sad this is. And gosh, if I descend any lower, then I'm going to be, this is what I'm going to have to do. So, okay, well, they'll have you go to it and then be sure don't do that anymore and maybe you'll be okay, you know? God. So, what happened to me was, of course, it was just, what I did was they ended up taking my license away on the like the one of the next drunk drivings, and I remember some guy gave me some. He goes, "Yeah, just don't take the breathalyzer, and they'll just give you a 6-month license suspension." I'm like, "Good idea." Oh, Jesus Christ! So sure enough, they did that, and then I had such a Jones for alcohol, so bad from this coke tolerance, that by this time, these guys told me, they said, you know what, you're a good guy, but you gotta go. And so I left there, but I was on the streets of Santa Barbara going, what in the hell am I gonna do now? And I realized I had to have alcohol in my system 24 hours a day or I started getting sick and seeing things. You know what I mean? DTs and what. So it really got bad. I ended up getting drunk in public, petty theft, and a few things. And what happened was it came to some culmination where I remember going before a judge and just somehow, like, how much, if I just go to jail, or have you lump it all together, what can we just get this over with? So 6 months in jail, and that'll do it. Bam, you know, so I was able to just do 4 months on a six for good behavior. God, I tell you, I was lucky. And anyway, but when I was in there, my this guy I was in there with, I told him that my granny lived in Goleta and she had some inheritance for us, and you know, maybe there's hope in the future as we're sitting wondering what in the hell is going to happen with our lives or something. And he goes, well, why don't you ask her to help you out when you get out because you need it? I'm like, hey, that's a great idea. So he coached me to go talk to her when I got out. And my granny, God bless her, she goes, okay, honey, here, you know. And it was like $6,000, more money than I'd ever seen in one place at one time at that age. And I was like, oh my God, this is great. So but I did have a sincere intention. I was going to come up to the Bay Area, get back in junior college or whatever, and just straighten up and fly right. So I get up here. No, you know what happened? I get on the Amtrak train and I see the sky car with the open thing. And I go, gosh. You know, I could just have a beer and just, you know, that's okay. Why not? So by the time I got here, I was so drunk from not having a drink for 4 months but I was able to kind of hold it together. My mom, God bless her, said I could just stay at home until I got my feet on the ground, something. And I had this $6,000 and you know what, and it was all good. It was 1983. You know, I remember Boy George came out with, you know, some few things and some cool things were happening. I'm like, oh, I'll be okay. This is great. And it, you know, but then I Jesus Christ, I get here and so I had this great idea. I'm just going to put the money in the bank on Solano Avenue and just take out $10-$15 a day. Get a six of Mickey's Big Mouth and just go sit at the park and figure out what to do. Good idea, right? Oh my God. So, in no time at all, well, I paid for a room for rent in advance, 3 months in advance, thinking I better do that just so I'll have, you know. God, I swear to God, it didn't take, I think I got here the end of March, 1983. By this time, I was homeless, broke, insane, and just, what the fuck, how did this happen again, you know? And you know, it's fast forwarding here, somehow this is really bizarre. I'm like, I met my old friends here who were like hardcore, my friends from Albany High. We're mostly dead now, most of them, but one of them, my best friend, he rips me off for my money so he can do his heroin habit. And you know, I just remember waking one. This is a true story. I was in Albany, right off of Gilman. There's a little creek off of Tevlin, and I had to have alcohol in my system 24 hours a day. So I'd get like a pint or a half pint of vodka and a 40-ounce malt liquor, like holy shit, 800. You know, gotta have the powerful something. God, is that nasty stuff? You know, you think about it. You know what I mean? So anyway. So I drink this at like right after early morning, and I by the creek, and I just pass out, you know, just fuck, safe or whatever I'm thinking. And I come to, and there's this guy across the creek watering, you know, his property, and he looks over, and he's like, oh, what the heck? So he puts the water down, and he kind of wades, he parts the weeds, and he comes through, and he's like, hey, are you okay? You know, and I'm like, God, what do you think, you know? And he goes, well, it just so happens I'm a counselor at Newbridge, this place in Berkeley. And I'm like, I did not hear, here's your chance to save your ass, you know, and really change your life, young man. No, I heard, 3 hot meals and a place to sleep? Hell yeah, brother, sign me up. You know, that's what it took, you know? So I go up to Newbridge, and Newbridge at that time, this was the 18-month program, 9 months, most of these people, everybody was probated by the court. Either go here or go serve some serious time for your little sticking up 7-Eleven habit that, you know, this guy cooked with. I like that guy, Keith. What a good guy. And then all these people, and then they would ask me, so what did you do? I'm like, oh, well, nothing, you know. But anyway, so that was my introduction to, you know, recovery, real hardcore recovery. And it came down to, I got to a point where I wanted to leave. I'm just sick of this. Fuck, these people are Nazis. This is crazy. Fuck you. I'm out of here. Especially when some little goody two shoes ass kisser dude is telling me, you know, what? And I'm like, fuck you. I'm going to kick your ass. And they're going to go, oh, that's threats of violence. You're going to have to be sit on the bench for a week. And this is this thing. See what it was is they had this big mirror, and you're supposed to stand in front of this mirror and look at yourself and reflect on your behavior. Man, I'm still hallucinating. Fuck. This is years later. Now I'm saying that was hard. But anyway, so but what it came down to was this counselor took me out in the backyard, and he goes, oh, so you want to leave, huh? Well, you can leave. He says, you can leave. What are you going to do? You know, what are you going to do? And I'm like, fuck, I don't know. Just get out of here, you know? And he's like, so I don't know. This guy reached me, and he talked me into staying. And son of a bitch, I did not complete the program, but I got 11 months, and I got a job right away as a mechanic out in town, you know, bam. It was awesome. And, the story didn't get, you know, suddenly, he's doing great. No. I started drinking with that guy, with a head mechanic at lunchtime, and I fucking had to go do another year of research. Get dragged through it again, you know, and, long story short, I ended up going to, Holloman Detox out in Richmond. Just had a grand mal seizure. I was in a hospital for a week somewhere. I don't even know where it is to this day. And then as of July 11, 1985, I haven't had a drink or a drug, you know? And my God, man, Jesus, was that hard to get, you know? So, you know, I don't look so bad today, right? You know? But, you know, I just want to say, you know, if you're, you know, new to Alcoholics Anonymous or recovery, because, you know, it isn't just alcohol anymore. Hasn't been for a while, you know. You know, and it's, you know, and you're not happy or you just feel fucked up when you go away. You know, we're all laughing now, and then we go home, and it's like, fucking now what? You know what I mean? You know, I tell you, this program has given me through that trite bullshit I used to hear from people, like, one more guy says he's a grateful alcoholic, I'm gonna fucking scream. You know, or some other guy, keep coming back, yeah, fuck you, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I didn't know what else to do, so I just did. I was scared to take a drink, another drink. Because, you know, I'm just scared, so fuck it, what are you gonna do? I don't know, go to a meeting. So I went to this veteran's home up in Yountville because I was a veteran. Thank God I was a veteran. Holy shit. They go, oh, my God, he's a veteran. Jesus Christ, I'd probably be dead. Seriously. I don't know if anyone's had the experience of being really sick, really toxic, and start going through the phone book. You know, oh, I'm sorry, can't help. No, there's nothing. Oh, man, it's frickin', that's reality. So I remember leaving I went up there and I got to do that and some Berkeley support services had signed me up for SSI at some point. I don't even remember when. So I get a call up there, are you such and such? And they go, yeah, well, you're such and such came through. And I'm like, wow, what? $7,000 and a payee and what? So I came down to Berkeley and I just started, I'd been clean and sober a little while. I think they told me in January of 86 that this was going to happen. So I'm like, holy shit. So I came down here, I didn't know what to do. So I just started going to meetings morning, noon, and night. I didn't know what the fuck else to do. Thank God they were giving me, here's some money. You know, here, feed yourself, go to a meeting, and I'll talk to you later. You know, the payee guy, I'm like, God bless that. That saved my ass. And I didn't know how to do anything. And, so what happened was when I started going to meetings, I just felt like, I don't know what you have. I don't want what you have. It's just, okay, I'm just going to go because, you know. And then after a while, what happened to me was I started seeing something happened. People were kind, you know, they just would come up and say, hey, how you doing? You know, and they didn't want anything or, you know, they're just, I don't know. It's just this really slow thing started to happen where I started to feel like I liked the people that went here. God, this guy's, you know, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened where I went from thinking this was a sentence to this is an opportunity, maybe, you know, and so I just started going to meetings all the time, you know, and I remember one more little funny thing. I just got to tell you this because we're just who we are. We might not be drinking anymore, but we're still crazy, but it's good crazy, you know, and so I'm still like that. But early in sobriety, I remember the guy goes, you know, you've been so good. We're just going to give you the whole $7,000. And I'm like, oh, thank you, like this, you know, and I go. He goes, I'm going to go get an apartment. You know, I'm going to get an apartment. I'm going to what and what. And then as soon as that fucking money crossed my palm, I swear to God, what am I thinking? I go, you know, I have never had a Harley Davidson before. So I go, yeah, thanks a lot, man. You know, like this. And we didn't have to wear, this was before the helmet law came out. Man, I was like, oh my God, I'm shaking. So I buy me this Harley Davidson, you know, I'm 32 years old, never had something like this. All I could afford was Triumphs and BSAs because that's all I could afford. You know, so I get this thing, and then the hubbub all wears down, and I'm like, you fucking idiot. What the fuck have you done? I remember I'm sitting on Francisco Street, there was a couch on the side of this apartment building. I'm sitting there going, it's, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night, and I'm looking at this motorcycle going, you fucking idiot. But I just rode that thing to meetings, and, you know, somehow I just raised my hand to meeting. I said, you know, I'm so stupid. I go, fuck. I, you know, I was supposed to get an apartment and I fucking bought a motorcycle. God damn it. And this one guy comes up to me after the meeting and he goes, his name is Hans. He's this guy, I don't know where he is to this day. He's this Norwegian guy. He's some kind of machinist guy. He goes, hey, you know, I got a room in an apartment that you can rent if you're interested. And I'm like, really? And so it just started like that. Little things like that started to happen because I started going to meetings and just saying what was really going on, you know? And, you know, my life just got better, you know? And really fast forwarding here, I'll just get to like, okay, so now I'm 55 years old. Oh, my God. Well, I got a daughter who's going to be 20 next month. She's so beautiful. She's like, little pot smoker. Hope she doesn't get so much trouble like me. But you know, I just have this life. I never thought when I was back when ever. I'm sure my life is over. It's like, you know, this is, you know, that's too bad. You're just gonna whatever. I don't know what we think, right? And slowly from just going to meetings regularly, just looking around the room for who it looks like it's working for, kind of paying attention. Gee, they're here today. What are they doing? I don't know, take some notes, you know, and just, I don't know how it came about, but today, you know, rather than thinking, how am I going to squeeze 3 meetings into a week? Oh my God. Now, I'm like, the first thing I think about in the morning is what meeting am I going to go to today? Who am I, what friends, who, where are my homies at? My friends, you know what I'm saying? And I mean that. So, you know, and because I go there and it kind of like, because life is hard now. I'm so crazy. I got a divorce, right? And then I was able to buy a little house in Oakland for nothing. Right before the crazy-ass real estate thing happened, I bought this little house for $125,000. You know, it's like, wow. Well, you know, little small payments. And I was living in, I'll never forget, they all closed the door. And I'm like, oh, my God, this really happened. This was in March of 99. Well, everything went crazy. Everything started getting more and more and more expensive. So that little house gets to be worth $630,000 on paper, you know. And I'm a mechanic. I got this little hole in the wall shop in Berkeley. It doesn't even have a freaking concrete floor. And I'm just like wrenching away. This is great. You know, so then I get an eviction notice at one point. So push comes to shove, some guy goes, there's real estate people in AA, there's lawyers, there's all kinds of people. Oh my God. Anyway, so this one guy goes, hey, you know, you could borrow all this money and get something else. So I own this warehouse in frickin' Richmond that's 5,000 square feet. It's paid for with the money from the little house's way crazy inflationary equity. So I got this crazy, I got a mortgage of like really, it's $3,600 and some odd bucks a month, but I'm renting the house out for $2,000 plus. I rent parking spaces to collector cars and I'm making a little money. How the fuck did that happen? I don't even know. You know, I'm supposed to, I swear to God, I'm the guy that was sleeping in Live Oak Park, you know, collecting aluminum cans so he wouldn't be sick because the life, you know, I couldn't get a job. You know what happened? So here it is, all these years later, and like Ramey said, I love AA. I love AA, and moreover, I love the people that go here. You know, that are these interesting characters that all, when we get together, something really priceless, precious emerges that I take in my little heart and just go away and go, gosh, you know, there's hope. Or that sparkly, mysterious, I don't know what it is, it's here. You know, that I used to try to smoke and get. You know, I get this, Mate, I get the reprieve based upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I've heard this shit a million times. It's slowly sunk in a little bit, you know. I can draw upon it intuitively because when I don't know what to do, I just go hang out with you guys. I go hang out with people that are in recovery, and God, even at my worst, at my very worst, I figured this out. It's like, when my alcoholism is just going, hey, I know I found what the fuck isn't going to help you this time. That was divorce about 10, 12 years ago. You know, people just said, dude, just go to meetings. Just go, forget it. Just leave it outside for an hour and go to meetings. Just go to meetings, go to meetings. And I figured out that even when I'm at my most depressed, worst, I'm sure, fuck it this time, I fuck it. It's like, it takes 3 meetings a day for 3 days. I swear to God, that is like a foolproof formula for this alcoholic. Because at the end of that third day, I'm like, what the hell? What problem? What? Oh, yeah, hey. I don't know. It just doesn't have the gravity near. As my crazy squirrel brain is going to convince me that is so fucking important. No, there's always going to be problems. But it's just my perspective on it that I get. From surrendering to just, you know, a lot of us, I come from Berkeley, a lot of us have a problem with God. God, oh, I knew there was a catch, I'm fucking out of here. You know what I mean? It's like, but thank God for Berkeley, because Berkeley was, dude, you know, look around the room, get over that right now, because there's it's working for people here. You know, thank God we're not all fucked up on the day, same day, because after a few days of that, I'd be out of here. But so when you read the literature, he told me years and years and years ago, just go, good orderly direction, group of drunks. Just put that in there just to get past the fucking word. And then after a while, it kind of flows and you go, oh, okay. But you know what? This is the truth here. I actually believe in God now. As I was an agnostic, never raised with any specific religious denomination. But today I do believe that I can say God and feel good about it because it's all that I am not. And it's manifested in you guys and how I see you're living your lives and you're getting through these fucking problems and we're laughing about it. I'm hearing about something that's adding something special to my life and my day that I would not come up with by myself. No way. I would actually get more mentally ill. That's how I get. So it looks like I'm up to this end of it here. And I just want to, you know what? As God is God, I'm saying that word, is my witness. I love Alcoholics Anonymous and recall the 12-step programs. Fuck it. It's all for the ism. Whatever it is, I need more. The disease of more, you know. If it works, give me more, whatever it is. You know, I have a life today that I never knew I'd want. I never knew existed. And I'm going to keep coming back because it's the only thing that fixes me, you know. And I just want to thank Morgan for asking me to speak tonight. Thank you, all of you guys, for thinking it's important enough to show up.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.